Hey everyone, I'm Andy Kraft.
And I'm Aaron Kraft.
Welcome to the Health Hacked Podcast.
How was your 6-hour Facebook hiatus?
Oh, it was beautiful. I actually have been off Instagram. Like, I haven't been checking it very often, just in general. I don't know, I used to have a problem. Like, the first 6 months of the year, I would check it, really just all the pandemic and up till like 2 months ago, I'd check it all the time. But it was good. I've been really good about staying off the past 2 months, and it's been enjoyable. And then having 6 hours of just nothing at all, I think it was healthy. I think it was healthy for the entire world to have that break. Well, I'm sure a lot of people just went over to Twitter and spent their time there, but it was probably good for everybody.
I didn't even know that it happened until after the fact.
Yeah.
What day was it?
It was like in the middle of the day. So maybe, I mean, your average working person probably wouldn't have necessarily known. I think it started at 11 and came back like at 6 or something.
Yeah. I was just like, had a busy day. And then I popped open Facebook or Instagram and everyone's like, we're back. And didn't even know it was down. So
nice.
Yeah. I don't know. Some people were saying it was a hack. Some people are saying it's just some server issues. I don't know. I don't know anything about that stuff.
I'm sure even if it was a hack, I don't know. I don't know if they're legally required to disclose that, but I'm sure they'd do whatever they could to cover up
that. We would
that.
Never know. Yeah.
No.
Yeah, I think it was good for everyone.
It was, yeah. And I think if you felt relieved by, like during those 6 hours, like do yourself a favor, do that once a week. Just on a Sunday, Saturday, a weekend day, just cut it out. It feels really good. I've been doing that actually on Sundays. You and I both, I think we've talked about this, have been trying to not work at all on Sundays, like even any side hustle work, just nothing, just keeping it open. And I've been trying to stay off social media and just not even opening the news app on Sundays at all. So it's been one day a week. It's really refreshing just to take a break from everything.
No, I think we all need that, either change up the stimulation or minimize that kind of stimulation, I think, is mentally healthy for almost everyone. Another thing that happened is there's been this whole like debt issue. I mentioned it in the Health Hack newsletter. You see, they're like talking about, I'm not sure how serious they were, issuing like a $1 trillion coin.
Oh yeah.
So as some workaround to like lift the debt ceiling, but I think a few days ago, I guess when this came out, the Senate approved a short-term debt ceiling increase, which raises the debt limit by $480 billion, basically gets us to like early December, and then we'll probably have to deal with this again.
Yeah.
But like with this, as with everything, there was a battle between Democrats and Republicans, and a deal was finally reached when 11 Republicans joined Democrats in the vote to raise the debt limit. And this surprised a lot of people. Yeah, like a lot of people started asking questions like what changed, what caused 11 Republicans to change their decision. And it came out that a whistleblower or secret source from inside the White House announced that there was like a lot of bribery that took place to get them there. And this is actually the first time, we're actually the first to report on this. So this is basically coming to you. You're the first to hear about this. In some leaked email exchange, Democrats offered Republicans a lifetime supply of element for anyone who voted across party lines. And apparently 11 Republicans saw the appeal on that, and the rest was history with this debt ceiling thing. And, you know, philosophically, I'm torn on this. I hate bribery. I really do. I think it's wrong and corrupt, for all that engage in it. But at the same time, I mean, a lifetime supply of elements invaluable. I'm not really sure you can argue with that. If there was ever a asset to use as a bribery tactic, it's element. I mean, these congressmen and women, they're all rich. They don't need more money. But what they do need is the perfect balance of sodium, potassium, and magnesium. And yes, they could have just gone to drinkelementtea.com/healthact, but they opted for a lifetime supply in exchange for a vote. So that's that. I mean, I can't say I blame them. I'd be lying if I said I never used Element as a way to bribe people. It's just something you got to do sometimes. So if you need a bargaining chip in your life, go to drinkelementtea.com/healthact. You won't regret it.
That was a good one.
All right. Okay, so, but actually, like, going into real current events, you probably saw that there is a COVID pill that is in the works, and we put this in the latest issue of Health Hacked, and there was a lot, it was already a long article that I wrote up on that, and I didn't have time to cover everything I wanted to, so we wanted to do an episode to kind of dig deeper into this COVID pill. And what it is, we'll get into the creation of it, but it's an antiviral, so it's not a vaccine. It is not to prevent you from getting it. It's something you would take to treat it in the early stages of the virus. So antivirals are used for, they've been used for like influenza, treatment for HIV, herpes, hepatitis. So there's a lot of antivirals out on the market, and this one is specifically for, or they're marketing it, I guess, specifically for COVID. So it's not a vaccine. It's supposed to help with preventing the virus from spreading. And it has a really interesting history, and we kind of wanted to take you from the creation of it to where we're at today, and then go through some of the potential downsides of it. We want to give you both sides of this so-called miracle drug. So, Aaron, why don't you kind of kick us off by, the drug is called, I didn't even say the name, it's got a weird name, it's called Molnupiravir, I think that's how you say it, and they were actually toying with the idea of calling it Mjolnir, which is Thor's hammer, because it's smashing out COVID, apparently, so Molnupiravir. Why don't you walk us through a little bit about, like, how it even started being developed?
Yeah, there's not, in the headlines, there's not much information out on this, and mainly because the company Merck has not put out much information on this, so it's hard to find this stuff. So we did our best to dig in and find everything there was to know about this drug, and it actually started a long time ago. This isn't something that they just started producing in 2019, 2020. It's something that's been around in development since 2013, and this isn't uncommon for a drug to start its developmental, you know, decades ago, but then they kind of shift it and market it towards a different, like, they'll figure out it works better at healing something else or at fixing something else. Right. So then they'll market it differently than what they intended to use it for. So that's not uncommon with pharmaceuticals. So the discovery and early development of this began in 2013 by a drug development subsidiary of Emory University. They were focusing on finding an orally available antiviral agent for the treatment of a virus called the Venezuelan equine encephalitis. Encephalitis. Yes. Encephalitis. We got some challenging words to pronounce here. Encephalitis virus. Venezuelan equine encephalitis virus, aka VEEV, VEEV. So I'm just going to say VEEV going forward. It's easier to say. And interestingly, the research originally started in response to reports that VEEV was going to be weaponized during the Cold War. So they wanted to get a head start and find a fix to this. And they never found one. So in 2013, they began looking for a fix to this. And VEEV is one of three known viruses that are transmitted by mosquitoes, and they can lead to outbreaks of severe encephalitis, which is a brain disease that basically causes inflammation in the brain. And if you get this, if you get encephalitis, it's very fatal. There's three diseases. For one of them, I believe it's, I don't know which variant it is. It's not this one. There's a separate variant that is very deadly, and 75% of the people who get encephalitis from it end up dying. So it's pretty potent. So to get a drug to market, it was basically required that the drug candidate be active against all three of these encephalitic alpha viruses. The goal was to address more than just that, though. They wanted it to also be able to protect against other RNA viruses, which SARS-CoV-2 is an RNA virus. So after years of development and testing on the drug, they got to a point where they did find it to inhibit replication of just that, of multiple RNA viruses. So this included influenza, it included other coronaviruses, it included respiratory viruses, and even the Ebola virus. So fast forward to early 2019. The next logical step for them was to get this to market as a treatment for the seasonal flu. There's a ton of cases for the seasonal flu every year, so this was the most logical thing to try to get to market for and to help. So they started preparing an investigational new drug application, an IND, for this drug, and they were going to use it against influenza. But in early 2019, in early 2020, fast forward a year, so they spent a year getting this drug application together. A year later,
for influenza, right? Like that was kind of the plan going into 2020. Hey, we're going to prepare this. Molnupiravir will be geared towards influenza.
Correct. January of 2020, obviously pandemic is getting bad. It's really bad in China. It's coming over into the US at this point. And the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, BARDA is the, how do you say that? They began requesting information on potential countermeasures against COVID-19. So we were just trying to figure out at this time, they wanted all of the information out there. Any drug company that had a potential countermeasure, they wanted that information. So Emory, knowing that their drug was prevented replication of RNA viruses.
You're gonna have to cut this out. He's got COVID, people.
Ah, I might.
Do you need to get some water?
I do. All right, we good?
Yeah.
I'm good.
Yeah.
So in response, Emory submitted basically an overview of their drug to BARDA. Their drug had shown signs that it was effective at inhibiting replication of RNA viruses, even coronaviruses. So they submitted their application, and they actually never received a response back. But they did get a response back from the FDA later in February of 2020, requesting for them to send all available information and activity on their drug and how it had how it worked against specifically coronaviruses. So Emory sent that to the FDA, and they also proceeded to file their IND for influenza. Still, they wanted to get this the clinical trials going because those can take years to get through. So they still, even though they were communicating with the FDA, for coronavirus, they were continuing to file their IND for influenza. They wanted these phase one trials to get moving as quick as possible. Then, interestingly, they transferred. There's a licensing deal that went on here. So Emory basically gave up their rights to this drug to a biotech company called Ridgeback Biotherapeutics. So the IND for the treatment of influenza was then transferred to Ridgeback Biotherapeutics. This was in April 2020, just a few months later. And then Ridgeback submitted a second IND for the treatment against COVID, no longer influenza. That was the main concern at this point. So now Ridgeback Biotherapeutics is the owner, per se, of this drug. And they're trying to get it to market as a COVID pill, essentially. Then on April of 2020, they got a letter from the FDA. Ridgeback got a letter from the FDA saying, you're safe to proceed. Continue, working with this drug. You can go ahead and do your clinical trials. So phase one clinical trials began. So that's kind of a background here. And the reason we give that background is so people know that this has a long history. This isn't something that has they just started creating, you know, within the past 6 months and rushed to get it to market. It has been studied and worked on and showed to be effective against coronaviruses years and years and years ago. So, I mean, COVID or SARS-CoV-2 specifically is different than other coronaviruses for sure, but they have been working on this for many years. But
yeah,
we're at a point now to where they're trying to get it to market specifically for SARS-CoV-2. So, Andy, do you want to get into maybe go into some of the overview things that we talked about in the newsletter just to kind of set the stage for what this pill is now? Where are they currently with it? Because they're through phase one and I believe even phase two.
Phase two, phase three is like wrapping up. And throughout phase one or phase two, Ridgeback kind of needed some help with production and research. So they got Merck involved, which is what you've been seeing, Merck's drug, and that they've been the ones associated with this COVID pill. And so that's when Merck got involved during these early trials. We're now wrapping up phase three. So that brings us to June of 2021, when phase three clinical trials were in process. At that point, the U.S. government entered into a procurement agreement with Merck to purchase 1.7 million courses of molnupiravir for $1.2 billion. So this is as phase three trials were ongoing, which ends up being about $700 per treatment. And the treatment is four pills twice a day for 5 days. So 40 pills over the course of 5 days ends up being about $1,750 per pill.
And I don't know if we mentioned this. This is once you've gotten COVID, like you've been diagnosed with COVID, you then take this pill. That way you basically overcome COVID quicker. And the idea is that you are less likely to become hospitalized.
Yeah. And the earlier, the better, with as is common with antivirals, because the way antivirals work is it stops the disease from replicating. Spread, that's the goal, is to stop the disease from replicating. If you don't take this for, you know, a week later, well, the virus has already spread a lot. So the earlier, the better here. That's kind of the idea. As soon as you find out you have COVID, you would do this five-day treatment. Now, this procurement agreement is contingent on the drug getting emergency use authorization or approval by the FDA. Fast forward to September 1st of 2021, phase three trials, that's when they were recruiting. And I just wanted to go through some of the enrollment criteria because I think it's important to know what population are they testing on. You had to have a confirmed COVID infection and symptomatic less than 5 days ago. Again, key here is early treatment. You had to have at least one characteristic or underlying medical condition associated with an increased risk of severe illness, so obesity, diabetes, autoimmune condition. And then this was interesting. For men, they had to abstain from heterosexual intercourse without protection or must agree to use contraception during the trial. Women could not be pregnant or breastfeeding or trying to get pregnant or had the potential to get pregnant, meaning they must also use contraceptives. So they didn't want children, they didn't want reproduction to happen during this trial. So I think that's an important note. Okay, and then October 2021, and this is the news that you probably all heard last week, they announced interim data from the phase three trial. The trial was 29 days long over the course of September. They had 762 at-risk adult patients with mild to moderate COVID, and they measured deaths and hospitalizations. So of those 762, about half of them took the drug, molnupiravir, and half took placebo. Those that took molnupiravir, their hospitalization rate was 7.3%. And then the placebo group, their hospitalization rate was 14.1%. So this is where you get those stats, this pill cut hospitalization by 50%. That's where that stat comes from. In regards to death, molnupiravir, there were no deaths in those that took molnupiravir. And then there were 8 deaths, which was about 2% in the placebo group. So, I mean, pretty good results. And Merck said, based on the participants with available viral sequencing, molnupiravir demonstrated consistent efficacy across viral variants, including gamma, delta, and mu. And what that means is that of those 762, some of those, so 40%, had data on which strain it was. And it seemed to show similar results against those strains. Now, but that's all we have. So 40% of 762, what is that, like 280, maybe 300? So that's what we have data on as far as variance. No further details on that. So it's smaller sample for in terms of looking at the variance. But
yeah,
since
this we don't even have the study yet, do we? This is just was it a press release released by Merck? Is that where this information comes from?
Yeah. So I think that is an important note. This wasn't like a study that was released and reviewed. This was preliminary data released by the company. Now, it did. They claimed that there was an independent, can't remember what they call it, an independent agency, I think from the FDA, that looked at least the data before they released it. And I mean, that would be pretty fraudulent if they announced all this data and then when it actually came out that it wasn't true. I mean, not saying it couldn't happen, but yes, the only data we have right now is from the company.
Okay. Now, did they say anything about side effects? Were there people who often during trials, a few people have to leave the trial because they had bad side effects? Did they, report or record on who had bad side effects, or were there any at all?
Yeah. We don't have any details on what kind of side effects. What we do know is that there was really no difference in adverse side effects between the two groups. So adverse events were 35% with molnupiravir, 40% with placebo. So actually more adverse events with placebo. Now, adverse events, that's basically anything outside of the ordinary. So even if you just get a headache one day or some ache or you're more tired than normal, that would be considered an adverse event. Now, they try to identify drug-related adverse events. Again, I'm not sure how they did that, but for drug-related adverse events, it was 12% for molnupiravir, the drug, 11% with placebo. So almost equivalent. And then there were just a couple people that actually dropped out due to the adverse events. That's that in terms of the side effects. And that's been another big claim is, look, no difference in side effects between placebo and the drug.
Now, I think one of the pushback here is that, at least from what we know from the public's perspective, there's really just been this one phase three trial with 760 people, which if you're pushing this COVID pill out, I mean, it's going to potentially be taken by millions and millions of people. 760 is not a lot of people. It's a pretty small group for a pharmaceutical trial. Are they planning to do more, or are they kind of ending it here at testing it on 760 people?
Well, that's what was interesting. So the initial goal was to enroll 1,850 participants. And they had almost recruited that many, but they stopped recruitment early due to these positive interim results. They decided that it would be unethical to continue to give participants in the trial with COVID the placebo when we know how effective the drug is. So I don't know if they're going to continue to at least do work on those that are recruited. It sounds like no. It sounds like they're not planning on doing another placebo group because they think it would be unethical because, in their words, it was so effective.
Okay.
So with these results, Merck plans to submit an application for emergency use authorization to the FDA as soon as possible, and their hope is that they'll get it approved before the end of the year. And funny enough, they're already in the process of manufacturing enough pills to treat 10 million people by the end of this year. And they've already entered into procurement agreements with other countries. Can't remember the countries off the top of my head. So the expectation is that this will get approved very, very shortly. And because I'm a finance guy, I do find the stock implications of this interesting. Their share price rose 13% in the days following, and then Pfizer, their share dropped that same time period. But I think Pfizer's went back up. So, I mean, that's normal, when announcements like this come out. So that's a rundown of where we're at with this thing. And it's kind of been touted as a miracle drug, a game changer, impressive results, etc. Go look at any article around this, and there's a lot of hype around it. And I know we know the media loves hype because it gets clicks, but I want to go through a few downsides where it seems like the downsides that aren't really getting a ton of attention. I think, with this in particular, it's easy to focus on the results because, they sound great. But I want to provide a well-rounded view of this thing. So we're going to look at some of the downsides. Number one being it's pricey. Now, this actually I've seen some articles written on, and they've gotten some backlash for this. So as I mentioned, the price that the U.S. purchased it for was $700 per course, per treatment, and $1,750 per pill. Now, my understanding is that with these government contracts, like the U.S. pays a premium on that, like to get first access. I think that's pretty common. Now, if it becomes standard treatment for people, I don't know what the end cost will be to the patient. I think early on, like with the vaccine, it'll be paid for by the government. Well, us, through our taxes, but through the government.
Do you know how much it costs? Does anywhere talk about its cost to produce? Like, I know with stuff like this, a lot of the cost, is, you know, there's the production cost itself, but a lot of the cost of drugs is R&D. Like, they spend, like this one specifically, it's been in development since 2013, like years and years and years. Mm-hmm. Of research and development. So tons of costs that they need to basically make up for. And they probably expected to get this to market for influenza, which is a recurring thing that happens every single year. And they probably expected to make quite a bit from that recurring annual revenue. That didn't happen. Now they have this. Mm-hmm. So does it mention how much it costs just to produce these pills?
Merck didn't announce the cost, but what was interesting is like that same day or a few days later, Harvard did an analysis where they estimated the cost of production based on the ingredients. I'll put that in the show notes. It's actually pretty interesting. So they estimate that the cost of producing a single pill is 44 cents compared to the $17.50
How many pills are in a trial or in a healing therapy?
40. So it would be 1774 for a full treatment, where the U.S. paid about 700 for that.
Okay.
Which is like a 35 to 40 times markup. I've seen articles on a 4,000% markup, which that's where that number comes from.
Okay.
And this Harvard's analysis estimated that, you know, assuming a 10% profit margin, allowance for taxes, a reasonable generic price for this drug would be about $20 for a 5-day treatment. And right now they're charging $700. Again, I'm sure they're trying to recoup R&D, and they know that someone, you know, they're going to pay that because of just the situation that we're in.
Yeah.
Now, that was one data point from a U.S. contract. Like I said, the cost could go down, but that first dose was definitely a huge markup. And I mean, this is going to be a huge moneymaker for sure. Not saying that means it's bad. They obviously put a lot of money into this, but that's just a downside, the price. Now, this is obviously a lot cheaper than intravenous antivirals like remdesivir, monoclonal antibodies. Those are both in the thousands of dollars and can only be treated at a hospital. So it's substantially cheaper than that, but a lot more expensive than some other cost-effective oral treatments that are still being studied for COVID. So fluvoxamine, I think that's how you say that, ivermectin, vitamin D, there's some amino acids being studied for COVID. I'll link to all the studies. Yes, I know one of those is very controversial. There, it is being studied for COVID. I'll link, and these are studies funded by the National Institute of Health. So these aren't hillbillies in their backyard doing tests. Like, these are legit studies. I'll post those in the show notes. You can see they're ongoing. Some of them are finished. What I think is interesting is they haven't gotten a lot of attention. Like, there seems to be, and we did an article in Health Act a while back, like about ongoing promising research with a lot cheaper treatments, like that are already out there, but those have not received the widespread praise and attention that this Merck drug has.
It's interesting, and it's anything that has been already FDA approved. A lot of those have been on market for a while, and once they've been on market for however many years, the patent is up. And then once the patent is up, no longer to just a single drug company able to make it, but a ton of people can make it. So ivermectin is one of those
it should be worth saying, Merck created ivermectin, actually.
Yes, originally. But the patent is gone, is up. Mm-hmm. So now any company knows the formula and can go basically reproduce ivermectin and sell it for basically pennies. So that's why a lot of these current therapeutics out there are a lot cheaper, because anybody can make them.
Right.
I don't know. Interesting.
I mean, that's kind of the way it works here.
I wonder for myself, like I got a horse farm right down the road from me. So like, look, if I get COVID, am I paying $700 a pill, or am I just going to go down to the horse farm and pick up some horse dewormer? Like,
yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. We'll see.
I think it is. It is interesting just how, like vitamin D, for instance, like that's been shown to reduce severity, and it just hasn't gotten the attention that this has. not saying that like this isn't, these results aren't impressive. That's just an interesting thing, I think. Okay, so that's kind of the one downside. It's pricey. Second is that it's still early. Like the preliminary results seem positive, but like Aaron said, this was a single study with a relatively small population for a very short period of time. And the data, like I said, is preliminary. It's from the company. I think further research is still warranted. Looks promising, but it is a single study. And I think widely distributing a drug that was only, you know, done one time with one group after 1 month may be unwise. And I don't think that the FDA would just approve it for everyone. If this gets approved, it'll be for the population being studied. That's generally how it's done. So at-risk people who aren't reproducing. That would be my guess. But we just need to be careful with early results. And that goes with anything. Those alternatives, cheaper alternative treatments that I mentioned, we need to be careful with early results around those and making claims around that. And then same with this. I don't know if anyone remembers this, but there's this huge Tamiflu stockpile issue that happened in the US back in 2005. The government entered into a contract with Roche to purchase $1.5 billion of the drug as a prevention method in the case that influenza became a pandemic. Well, allegedly, Tamiflu was not as effective as Roche had claimed. And as some physicians started looking into the data, it appeared that Roche had fudged some results by selectively reporting data that sort of skewed the results to look more favorable than they actually were. Now, there is an ongoing lawsuit against Roche for allegedly, you know, swindling the U.S. government into buying $1.5 billion of Tamiflu. I'll put a link in the show notes to that. Again, these things take forever, but the case is still ongoing. I think a couple years ago, maybe it was 2020, which I guess is almost a couple years ago now, they requested it to be dismissed, and they got rejected. So apparently there seems to be enough evidence to at least move forward with the lawsuit. So we'll see where that goes. All that is to say, just because a big pharmaceutical company makes these claims about a drug and the government agrees to spend a lot to acquire said drug, does not mean that that science is set in stone. And it also doesn't mean that, you know, because it happened once, it's happening here. Just because it happened with this Tamiflu doesn't mean the same thing's happening. All I'm saying is time will tell. I think we need to look at the data, you know, before we can start calling this thing a miracle drug.
So are you thinking this is going to be something that becomes like as widely as pushed as the vaccine, or is it going to be more like, you know, with the boosters, where it's only recommended for currently only recommended for a very specific set of group? Or are they going to say you get COVID no matter what, here's the pill?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like I said, the only population has been on at-risk patients. We don't even know how it will work at reducing deaths and hospitalizations in a healthy population. Mm-hmm. Also, it's worth noting that in phase two trials, this did not help people that were already hospitalized. There was no improvement in condition for those who were already hospitalized with COVID and they took this, which is not surprising for an antiviral. Like I said, the whole point is to stop the virus from replicating, which needs to be done early. Otherwise, the virus is going to keep replicating. So that's not really a surprise. But we don't know how it's going to impact those who are pregnant, trying to get pregnant or breastfeeding. There are just unknowns of potential birth defects due to the nature of the drug, which is a good segue into my next and final point, which is it could have some consequences. And this is where there is there's a stupid ant on my desk. Dude, pest guy
exterminator
two times.
Not helping.
Where was I? That just messed me up. So yeah, this, okay. So the could have some consequences. This is more getting into the controversy area where people disagree. But I want to explain high level, give you some context on how it works. So basically the drug prevents the virus from replicating by inserting itself into the RNA structure of the virus. And that causes the virus to mutate in a way that it can't continue to reproduce. And then in doing so, it prevents the virus from spreading and causing more harm. So the concern is that it could be, this drug could be mutagenic in human cells, meaning if it integrates into our own genetic material, that could potentially lead to tumors, cancer, birth defects. But there's a lot of back and forth debate on this, and I'm not really sure that it's settled at this point. Merck says that they ran extensive tests on animals for mutagenicity, and they said it's not a concern. But there was a study published in August of 2021 showing that molnupiravir, this drug, was highly mutagenic in animal cell cultures, so in a petri dish, not in a live animal. Now, on the flip side, so this group of scientists is saying, hey, this is an issue. This is mutagenic in animal cells. Are we sure we want to be putting this in humans? Flip side, other scientists are saying, well, when you test for mutagenicity in vitro, it does not translate well to in vivo tests, like live animals and humans. Results are just inconsistent. Raymond Shinazi, I think is his name. He's a professor of pediatrics and the director of the Division of Biomedical Pharmacology at Emory, where this was developed. He wasn't involved in the work here, but he studied NHC, which is a metabolite that's produced when molnupiravir is consumed. He is the one that wrote that paper on how molnupiravir was mutagenic, and he's kind of coming out saying, I think we need to be careful here. They apparently shared their results with Merck back in 2020 before the study was published, and Merck came back and said, basically, like, look, we've tested in animals and we have shown no issues. They said they ran two separate tests on animals, Merck did, and in which molnupiravir was given to them in high doses for a lot longer than would be given to humans if you made it a human equivalent, and that there were no results showing mutagenicity. But then again, there's just this back and forth. Then the authors of the study came back and said, you still need to be careful. You really should be demonstrating lack of cancer in animal and humans for a longer period of time before, you know, giving it to people. And if you give this to people, it should be limited to very high risk people. So a lot of disagreement on that. In the end, it's still early. I don't think this seems to be 100% risk free. We just don't know. It's not guaranteed that it's not mutagenic. I'm not saying that it is. We just don't know for sure. At this point, I think it's too soon to tell what role this pill will serve in treating people with COVID. I mean, the results look good. The media and Wall Street are really hyping this thing up. And I guess I'm kind of moving into opinion now. But I think if these circumstances were shown with another already available cheaper drug, I don't think it would be getting as much hype as it is. I think there's just something about it being new and backed by Merck that makes it more marketable.
We have seen that with a few other drugs. I mean, we're not going to get into the details of it, but I mean, I think the article we looked at in HealthHack was that there are 14 FDA-approved drugs that are initially showing promising signs, and there are some, like, quite frankly, some good studies out there. I don't want to say good studies. There are some positive studies out there on ivermectin. There's some bad studies on ivermectin, but there's other many other drugs as well that are already on market, that are already cheap, they're very easy to produce, that have promising results, and they've kind of just been overlooked, and they're really not even being studied. Like, I feel like the first step back in like 2020, like the first step is like, okay, let's look at every single FDA approved drug and test every single one, like right now. Like, we need to get this thing fixed, we need to find a therapeutic. You'd think that would be step one. And we just haven't heard. I mean, maybe it was done. I don't know. We haven't heard anything about it if it was. But there are some drugs out there that have promising initial results, but It doesn't seem to be pushed as hard as this is being pushed.
Yeah. Yeah. And look, I mean, I hope that this works and that this saves lives. It's just there are potential downsides which aren't getting a lot of attention.
Yeah.
And it's just being touted as this miracle drug, where I think, well, like, let's look at the other side too. It very well could save a lot of lives. Hope it does. But I think we still have a ways to go before we can say with confidence, you know, talk about it with confidence around the efficacy and safety of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think, I mean, the encouraging thing here is that it's been around. This has been in development since 2013. It's not something brand new. They didn't rush it. Signs don't show that it is dangerous, or, I mean, I guess we don't know the specific side effects, but it does not, hasn't killed anybody. Whereas, I mean, the vaccine has, I mean, it's very, very rare, but the vaccine has caused deaths and it's caused some severe side effects, and especially young males. Like, that's a real thing. It is rare, but it's a real thing. With this, I mean, detrimental side effects don't appear to be present.
In the population, at least in the population that we have right now, which is 700 people.
I think more the concern may be the mutagenicity of it.
Right.
And seeing how, we just don't know how that will play out in humans. So that seems to be more of a concern than the safety of it.
Yeah, yeah. So we'll see. I mean, time will tell. As more comes out on this, I guess we'll probably keep you all posted. But I think that's it.
That's a wrap.
All right. If you're not already, subscribe to Health Hacked at healthhacked.com so you can get the latest on all this stuff. And thank you all for listening.